The Obama administration has put the brakes on developing what the oil industry calls the Saudi Arabia of the Rockies. Locked away inside the Rocky Mountains is so much oil, it's estimated to be three times the proven reserves of Saudi Arabia. But it is called oil shale. The Bush administration had planned to start leasing land to oil companies looking for a way to mine this potentially valuable resource. But President Obama's administration has pleased environmentalists by switching to a go-slow approach. From Denver, NPR's Jeff Brady reports.
Way back in 1882, Mike Callahan learned a difficult lesson about oil shale. He built a log cabin on the banks of Parachute Creek, and for the fireplace,
he used some rocks that he found abundantly in the area, these dark brown rocks that they quarried really nicely. They broke nice and straight and flat.
That's Jason Hansen with the Center of the American West at the University of Colorado. And what Callahan didn't know is that in the tiny pores of that rock was a hard substance called kerogen. And when it's heated to about 650 degrees, it converts to oil and gas.
He lit a fire in the fireplace. And at that point, his housewarming turned into a bad pun.
And all that hard work went up in smoke. For much of the past century, entrepreneurs have tried to figure out how to make money off all those hydrocarbons locked away in shale. There have been many false starts, and there's a saying around here that oil shale has always had a promising future, and it always will. In general, research has boomed when gasoline prices were high and busted whenever they dropped. In 2005, Congress passed an Energy Policy Act, which included directives to encourage oil shale development in Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming. Last fall, the Bush administration finalized rules for leasing public land to companies working on oil shale, but then environmentalists challenged them in court. David Abelson is with Western Resource Advocates.
Number one, they have a very low royalty rate, which with a low royalty rate, you're in essence serving to subsidize global warming.
And Abelson says there's just not enough information yet to establish regulations. He worries it'll require almost as much energy to extract the oil as it'll produce. Plus, just about all the processes being considered require huge amounts of water.
We firmly believe that oil shale is a cruel hoax. It doesn't deliver the promise that people hope it does, and in fact would have minimal increased energy production with a high carbon output.
Abelson says the U.S. should focus instead on developing cleaner sources of energy. He's pleased the Obama administration recently withdrew research leases that were put out for bid as President Bush was leaving office. Those leases were so large, they look suspiciously like they were intended for commercial development instead of just research. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar agrees with environmental groups that the royalty rates on oil shale were too low, and his department is slowing down the Bush administration's aggressive development plan. Despite this, oil companies say they're still big believers in oil shale.
Well, Shell is in this for the long term.
Tracy Boyd with Shell says oil shale will become economical because there's one truth that no one can deny. The oil that's easy to get to is becoming more difficult to find.
It's kind of like low-hanging fruit, and after you've grabbed all the low-hanging fruit, you have to reach a little higher. You have to work a little harder to develop the resource.
And Shell is betting that as oil becomes scarcer, prices will rise. And someday, this region will live up to its billing as the Saudi Arabia of the Rockies. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. None of us likes to hear that we're aging prematurely, but according to a new study in the New England Journal of Medicine, the smoggy air that many of us breathe is both damaging and aging our lungs. As NPR's Allison Aubrey reports, that means that people exposed to high levels of ozone over their lifetime are significantly more likely to die from lung disease.
If you happen to be listening to this broadcast in Los Angeles, Houston, New York, Washington, or Baton Rouge, raise your hand. Okay, don't, actually. But do imagine this. If all the hands of people living in smoggy, ozone-polluted areas went up, we'd have 100 million arms raised. That's how many Americans live in places with unhealthy levels of ozone.
That is a lot of hands. It's a third of the population of the country.
John Balmes is a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. He says we've known for a long time that summer summertime, spikes in smog cause health problems. Kids with asthma get flare-ups. Hospital admissions for respiratory diseases increase. But this new study provides evidence that cumulative exposure to elevated levels of ozone over the long term is more dangerous than we knew.
The study points to the fact that there may be a threefold increased risk of dying from respiratory disease in the smoggiest areas of the country.
Living in a smoggy city, breathing smoggy air, actually increases your risk of death?
Yes, that's true. And this is really the first study to provide convincing evidence of that.
So here are some details about the study. It included 450,000 adults who were followed for almost 20 years as part of an American Cancer Society study. During these two decades, about 118,000 people died. When researcher Michael Jarrett of UC Berkeley and his colleagues teased out the causes of death, they realized that people living in the smoggiest cities were 30% more likely to have succumbed to lung diseases, such as chronic bronchitis, emphysema, and pneumonia.
That's even after we control for 44 individual factors like smoking, alcohol consumption, occupational exposures, a number of neighborhood factors like unemployment and poverty. So even when we control for all those variables that could affect mortality, we still see a very strong and clear signal.
So how can people cope during the summer smog season when the problem is acute? People with respiratory conditions such as asthma know to stay indoors. Also, some cities offer free public transportation on red alert days. But when it comes to chronic cumulative exposures that this study shows to be dangerous, physician John Balmes says there's not a lot individuals can do.
We know that ozone causes inflammation of the airways, and that chemical burning of the airways makes people more susceptible to infectious agents like bacteria or viruses, which cause pneumonia.
If people are interested in reducing smog, experts say the best thing they can do is to drive less, especially during the summer months. Most emissions in the smoggiest cities do come from cars and other vehicles. Another way to cut ozone is to change federal regulations. Researcher George Thurston of New York University says the clean air laws that helped reduce smog throughout the 80s and 90s were aimed at preventing summertime spikes.
The law of the land was that they restricted the peak levels on the highest days of the year.
Given the new evidence, there will likely be a push for a new annual average standard aimed at further reducing the overall burden of smog. Alice Naubry, NPR News, Washington.
Lions. You might see or hear them at the movies, but real-life lions are disappearing.
The iconic king of the jungle is another victim in a world running out of room for wild things. Now biologists have evolved a startling strategy to save them. Back from a field trip to Kenya, here is our own Alex Chadwick.
Contrary to that old pop song, in the jungle, the mighty jungle, the lion does not sleep tonight. Lions hunt at night and nap all day. This is a snoring lion. But for not much longer, 30 minutes maybe, until the tranquilizer dart wears off.
Can you hold that head up? Thanks.
The man squatting beside the lion. I've spent most of this day with him, but just now, he shifts his weight and his shirt pulls up. Just now, I notice he's wearing a Colt automatic on his belt. That's in case Mr. Lion is a light sleeper. Days later, many miles away by a small river that drains north from a range near Mount Kenya, the Lion Man, Dr. Lawrence Frank, settles to the ground again. We walked here from his house. He's armed again, this time with a 470 Nitro Express double rifle. It could bring down an elephant, and there was one outside the house earlier, but we're talking about lions.
When you say the numbers are dwindling quickly, what are those numbers and how do you know?
It's terribly difficult to count things like lions, which are largely nocturnal, but the very best educated guesstimates of biologists across Africa is that something on the order of 30,000 lions still remain.
30,000, well, that's actually a lot for big cats. Lions aren't even on the red list for endangered species, but the trend, ugh.
20 years ago, perhaps 200,000. That was certainly not an accurate number, but it shows that people were confident there were still plenty of lions left.
200,000 20 years ago, 30,000 now. It's a crisis. Lawrence is a researcher at the University of California at Berkeley. Half the year, he's in northern Kenya in the Laikipia region, running a project called Living with Lions. There's open land here, forested along the stream beds, otherwise brush and plain, with hippos, giraffe, zebras, antelope, gazelles, and predators, leopards, hyenas, lions. Remember, says Lawrence, this is not a park. It's the last bit of East Africa with huge private ranches.
And these people in the last 20 years or so have come to see conservation as the way of the future. This is both economically from tourism, and also they're very, very deeply involved in the land and its people and its animals. This place is extraordinary. There's nowhere else like it in the world.
How many lions do you think are here?
I estimate something in the order of 200 to 250 lions, probably the only lion population in East Africa which is not declining. It's stable, if not increasing.
Hunting wildlife is illegal in Kenya, but the lions are dying out because people kill them. And it's easy to see who and how and why. The landscape is mostly dry rangeland. Country people herd cattle, sheep, and goats. And to a lion, these are slower, fatter analogs to antelope.
For a rural Kenyan, there is absolutely no financial upside to tolerating wildlife. Lions, hyenas, leopards eat livestock, occasionally kill people. If you're dependent on your herd of 30 cattle and a lion kills two of them one night, that's a tremendous blow.
The hunting ban in Kenya is more than 30 years old. Guns are more common now than they used to be, but it would raise questions to be caught with one near a dead lion. What has really changed here is the now much greater availability of what's become the number one lion killer, and that is poison.
For a few pennies, you can buy enough poison in any little rural store in Kenya to wipe out an entire pride of lions or group of hyenas.
The lion outlook is grim. Some will survive in wildlife parks, but their real wildness will be lost unless the people they live among get some value for the trouble. And so Lawrence Frank, conservationist, wildlife researcher, decades in Africa, comes to a difficult conclusion about nature and human nature, lions and all the other wildlife.
Either people pay a lot of money to watch it and take pictures and make movies of it, or they pay very high sums of money to shoot it.
Say what?
Shoot it. Shoot it. Shoot it. Shoot it. Shoot it.
Hunting. He means hunting. This from a conservationist. In South Africa, a lot of wildlife has rebounded on vast hunting reserves. For lions, hunters want the large old males with big manes.
I personally don't understand the appeal of shooting large male animals to hang on your wall. But in the case of the big game, it can bring in fantastic sums of money.
Yes, fantastic sums. Up to $150,000 for a permit to shoot one lion. Several Africa-focused conservation organizations endorse the hunting idea. Some animal groups are horrified by it.
Guys who want to shoot an elephant or a lion or a buffalo want a great big old male. They don't want a young breeding female. And the fact is that, as any man my age knows, old males are pretty pointless in the population anymore.
You can't hunt lions in Kenya now, Lawrence says. There aren't enough. But wildlife management is a science, he says, and you could manage them for sustainability. At Mugi Ranch in northern Laikipia, Lawrence sights along the barrel of a short rifle, the lightest weapon I've seen him carry. We're in a Land Rover. He's in back, passenger side, window down, aiming at a large male lion 20 feet away. The dart stings into lion's shoulder. A good shot. The anesthesia works quickly. Lawrence measures parts from teeth to testicles, all good lion data he's been gathering for years. Lions, of course, are only part of the equation. People live here. That's the name of his project, Living with Lions. It's not easy.
And yet, we as animal-loving Westerners feel that these people should just happily love animals the way we do, with never thinking about the realities that they face with these animals.
Conservation biologist Lawrence Frank of the University of California at Berkeley and the Wildlife Conservation Society and the Panthera Foundation. Looking for lions one evening, we cross a narrow river and pause to look down from a bridge. Two women are knee-deep in the water, filling big plastic jugs. There's a baby in a sling. Two young children are farther up on the bank. They'll all walk home, 2 or 3 miles from where we recorded this lion that night. Mothers, kids, very wild animals. I wonder what an American mom, even a conservationist, would think. Tomorrow, among the Maasai, lion hunters who become lion guardians. This is Alex Chadwick for NPR News.
You can read more about lions and see some amazing pictures at our website, npr.org. And thanks to National Geographic for help in producing that piece.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. President Obama's proposed budget contains huge amounts of spending, but not for everything. For example, there is no funding to dispose of the waste from nuclear power plants. The president is keeping a campaign promise by stopping the $8 billion project to prepare Yucca Mountain, Nevada, as the country's nuclear waste repository. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
The story of Yucca Mountain is actually a saga that has stretched out over 3 decades, and one of the key players is Senator Harry Reid of Nevada. Sometimes he sounds like a guy who believes the federal government should take precedence over states, like this comment last month about siting electric power lines.
We're going to move beyond one state being able to hold up forever something that needs to be done for the rest of the country.
Those words earned Reid a few quiet guffaws, considering they come from a man who has argued that Nevada has the right to kill the nation's nuclear waste plans. To be sure, Nevada got a raw deal back in the early 1980s when Congress chose Yucca Mountain as the nation's nuclear waste repository. Robert Fry from the think tank Resources for the Future says Nevada's congressional delegation at the time was simply outgunned.
It was not a decision that flew in the face of the technical considerations at all. But it was certainly a decision that was motivated at least as much by political considerations.
And now the political tables have turned. Harry Reid is the Senate's majority leader, and the Yucca Mountain Project is, if not dead, at least moribund. Robert Fry says this leaves the nuclear waste issue, once again, in limbo.
Yucca Mountain at some point, or something that looks a lot like Yucca Mountain, has got to be done.
Fry says the whole scientific community has agreed for decades that eventually nuclear waste needs to go in a deep hole underground.
But it doesn't need to get done right away. And the future of nuclear power, the building of the next few plants, doesn't depend on Yucca Mountain being completed anytime soon.
And the Obama administration's decision is hardly a seismic event for the industry. Alex Flint is at the Nuclear Energy Institute, the industry's trade group.
Well, it means in many ways that the current state of play continues.
That means electricity customers will continue paying into a nuclear waste fund, which has already collected $22 billion. It also means that the U.S. government is not taking nuclear waste off the hands of the nuclear industry, as it promised to do. Instead, Flint says plants have found ways to store their own waste in pools of water and in dry concrete casks on the ground.
In many ways, we've reduced the urgency of a need to find some other solution to this material. We can definitely deal with this material for decades or hundreds of years. It would be ideal to come up with some eventual disposition proposal in this regard, but we have a lot of time to figure that out.
This is a philosophical shift from the early days of the nuclear industry. Then President Jimmy Carter assumed that we needed to solve the nuclear waste issue up front in order to put the industry on firm footing. These days, the industry is saying, now that we have solutions that will suffice for many decades, that's good enough. Anti-nuclear activists like Jim Riccio at Greenpeace aren't buying it.
There still is no solution to the problem we've created over 50 years ago.
But digging a big hole in the ground and sweeping it under a rug wasn't an answer either.
The Energy Department plans to assemble a committee to review these issues this year. It has a big challenge as it attempts to deal with not only the question of nuclear waste, but global warming, too. Nuclear energy currently supplies 21% of the nation's electricity, and the plants do not produce carbon dioxide. So Robert Fry at Resources for the Future says the environmental arguments about nuclear power are shifting.
I don't think we're in a position to disregard any of the options for dealing with global warming at this point.
And the debate over Yucca Mountain has, in his view, become a bit of a sideshow. Richard Harris, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Shortly after becoming the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack stepped outside his department's headquarters building here in Washington. He took a jackhammer to a driveway. And now that the weather is getting warmer, his department plans to put a garden there. It was one small step for the man whose job is to remake Americans' approach to agriculture. The former Iowa governor argues that almost everything farmers do can affect what we eat, the energy we use, even our chances to fight global warming.
What they use in their farm equipment, what they plant, where they plant it, when they plant it, how they fertilize it, how they cultivate it, what they do once it's harvested, if they have livestock, what do they feed that livestock. There's also what happens underneath the ground.
Vilsack's agenda to change much of that is not entirely welcome. President Obama's administration faces criticism for its plan to reduce subsidies to larger farms. Yet when we sat down with the secretary, he argued in favor of the concept of farm subsidies.
The notion of subsidies is a complex one. We have in place support structures and safety nets that allow farmers to ride out difficult times. So the challenge is to figure out a way in which you can continue to have reasonably priced food and at the same time prosperous farmers. And that's where I think energy and climate change comes back into play, because you can foresee a future in which farmers are paid for reducing our carbon footprint, much in the same way that we're currently paying them for conservation. We're concerned about water quality. We're concerned about preserving the soil. And so we're willing to pay people to do things on their land that would be helpful not just to them but to us.
Are you saying you would want maybe someday to pay farmers for doing fertilizer-free farming or for putting up a windmill that generates electricity in a renewable way, or that sort of thing?
Well, I mean, there are a whole host of things, but I think it will be tied to the whole notion of offsets.
Somewhere there's a dirty coal-fired power plant that's polluting too much, and under this system you would envision the plant might pay a farmer to be storing carbon or to be doing something that's cleaner, and the farmer would end up making money that way.
It's that, or there's some kind of central distribution system that basically sells these offsets and contracts with the farmers for
right.
I mean, the structure is essentially as you've outlined. Eventually the farmer gets benefited for doing what is right for the country as a whole and for the globe as a whole, which is to reduce the carbon footprint.
I was very interested a moment ago to hear you speak in favor of the concept of agricultural subsidies, given that some of the largest headlines you've made since becoming secretary were proposing a reduction.
Well, what we're suggesting is that safety net is there for the farmers who need it. And I think we're also confronted with trillion-dollar deficits. You have to deal with the deficit. And it's all well and good for us now to invest substantial sums of money into the economy to have agriculture work and for Americans to get back to work. But at some point in time, we're going to have to deal with trillion-dollar deficits.
I was thinking about that, though. You're getting a big political backlash for this. And when you look at the numbers, I mean, you can save a few billion dollars over a few years, which is a lot of money, but in the context of the trillions that people now discuss, doesn't seem like a huge payoff. Are you concerned that you're going to invest too much political capital for a small payoff?
Well, you have to start that conversation somewhere. And there are many different twists and turns that can take place. Bottom line is the safety net has to work for people who need it. Bottom line is we have a deficit that has to be addressed in some way. And bottom line is that agriculture generally has to be open to change. And I think climate change and energy provide that opportunity.
Are you saying there's a much larger goal here than just saving a couple billion dollars? You want to remake agriculture?
I think agriculture needs to understand that nothing stays static. If you think that it does, just ask the folks at General Motors or General Electric or the banking industry. I mean, there's constant change. And I think there's tremendous opportunity. Americans more aware of what they're eating. Terrific opportunity to expand these small growers. We ought to be about encouraging our kids to be just terrific consumers of food. They ought to want different colored fruits and vegetables on their plate. They ought to demand it. They ought to be encouraged to do that. Tremendous opportunity for us in this energy and climate change discussion. It's change, and change is always difficult.
Secretary Vilsack, thanks very much.
You bet. Thank you.
Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack spoke with us in Washington. Listeners to this program may recall dramatic descriptions of drilling for gas in Colorado's Rocky Mountains. And now we have an update. That drilling has dropped more than 50% since last fall. There was a boom fueled by high gas prices and the Bush administration's willingness to open public lands. Now, as NPR's Jeff Brady reports, both those things are history, and a number of communities in Colorado are hurting.
Parachute, Colorado is one of those small mountain towns where people love to tell stories about famous bad guys from the past.
According to the lore they told us when we were looking at this building, this was the last bank that Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid robbed before they started robbing trains.
Clint Robinson manages a store that sells all kinds of drilling safety supplies like gloves, harnesses, and earplugs. That's an interesting tale about Butch Cassidy, but historians say it's probably not true. For Robinson, though, it's an amusing diversion from the decline in drilling that's hurting the business he opened just a few months ago.
We might have chosen just a little better time to get started here when the rigs were all coming in instead of going away.
Those rigs are heading to other parts of the country where the land is flatter and the drilling more profitable. But there's something else contributing to the slowdown. A new generation of Democratic policymakers is heeding warnings from environmental groups that wild areas in the Rocky Mountains are at risk. Tracy Haupt is a Garfield County commissioner.
There was a red target on the Colorado Rocky Mountain region for energy development, and things were moving so rapidly. Permitting was being streamlined. Protections were being exempted.
Haupt says the drilling boom is not the reason she first got into politics, but she says the boom was changing the environment here so rapidly.
I was very concerned that we were going to lose one of the most precious areas in the world to short-term greed.
Haupt also sits on Colorado's Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, which is putting new rules in place that require companies to jump through more environmental hoops to get a drilling permit. The industry has warned the rules are encouraging companies to drill elsewhere. One of the most active drillers in Colorado is Encana. Spokesman Doug Hawk says the company recently set aside $500 million to invest in drilling.
In making our decision on where to spend that, we chose to spend it all in Texas, Louisiana, and Wyoming, and none of it in Colorado, in part because of the uncertainty over the rules.
Hawk says Encana wasn't trying to send a message to policymakers in Colorado, but he says if they receive a message, it might be a good thing. Those in the natural gas industry say the talk coming out of Washington these days isn't very encouraging either.
The gas industry is in a conundrum right now.
Porter Bennett is CEO of Bentec Energy. He says another reason the Rocky Mountain boom has cooled is because there's not enough pipeline to transport gas to population centers. He says the Obama administration's focus on renewable energy is discouraging investment in natural gas.
When you look at national and local policies, those tend to discourage demand. So as a producer, are you going to put money into a pipeline? I don't think so.
But clearly, the most important factor here is the price of natural gas. When demand goes back up and prices follow, everyone agrees it's likely drillers will once again return to this rich and expensive source of natural gas in the Colorado Rockies. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.